It is with the greatest pleasure that I welcome all of you this evening to the second lecture of the 2019 Leon Panetta Lecture Series. As you know, we're again hosting tonight's lecture in the Monterey Conference Center Sarah Ballroom. We've done this because of the response we've had from the community and the need to make room for the additional requests we have received from the public. It's so gratifying that after more than two decades, the response to this year's season has been stronger than ever. Demand for tickets has been greater, and student attendance has been record-breaking. And I mean record-breaking. It was wonderful to again see a room full of students. Let me sidebar for a minute. You know, that's what the Panetta Institute is all about, is inspiring young people into leadership roles, into lives of public service. And we're doing that through our different programs. The lecture series is one of them. I know there are many reasons for this high level of interest. It's the timeliness of this year's theme and the wonderful list of speakers that Leon has put together. And I think the increased demand is also because we as a community are hungry for this kind of civic discourse, and that we all recognize how important it is to have the opportunity to discuss diverse points of view regarding the future of our democracy. Thank you for your interest, for your support, and of course, for being here tonight. This year, our theme is checks and balances. Will our democracy survive? Last month, we focused on the Mueller investigation, the rule of the law, and the presidency. Tonight, we turn our focus to two other important components of our democracy: the Congress, sometimes known as the people's branch, and the press, which is said to play the role of the fourth branch of government. No matter how they are described, these institutions serve an instrumental role in how our democracy functions. Each is designed and intended to be a watchdog of the other branch. The Congress, by lawmaking, managing the power of the purse and providing oversight, and the press, by reporting the news fairly to the American people. Today, there are real concerns about the ability of the Congress and the press to perform their functions as outlined in the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. Congress continues to be mired in gridlock and partisan dysfunction. The midterm elections have created a divided government, leading to questions about whether the House of Representatives will spend its time focusing on messaging and attacking the president, or concentrate on the very real need to legislate and govern the country. The press is President Trump's enemy of the people, creating an environment where it is difficult to determine how to identify unbiased and accurate reporting during this critical time for our nation. Tonight, we'll talk with these three experts who know the press, who know politics, who know campaigns, who know the Congress and the president inside and out. How can we preserve the integrity and the purpose of the press and the Congress? How can we identify potential areas of compromise? Are there procedural or structural reforms that would improve the ability of both institutions to perform their duties and protect our democracy for the future? Those are the questions that we'll ask tonight. Our first guest is a nationally known columnist and commentator who has worked in Washington through the administrations of 10 United States presidents. Mr. Shields first went to Washington in 1965 to work for United States Senator William Proxmire. In 1968, he joined Robert Kennedy's presidential campaign and later held leadership positions in three other presidential runs. For 11 years, he helped manage campaigns from the courthouse to the White House. he began writing his now nationally distributed column for the Washington Post in 1979 and held a 17-year stint as moderator and panelist on CNN's Capital Gain. He appears weekly on the award-winning PBS NewsHour, providing political analysis and commentary, and is a regular panelist on the program Inside Washington. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Mark Shield. Thank you, and welcome. Our second guest served as the 55th governor of the state of New Jersey, who gained national prominence as a moderate voice in the Republican Party. During his two terms as governor, he emphasized fiscal responsibility, pension and health benefit reform, education reform, and addressed the opioid crisis. He also devised the state's groundbreaking bipartisan response to Superstorm Sandy. He was elected chairman of the Republican Governors Association in 2014 and led the organization to a record fundraising effort along with the election of 31 Republican governors. In June 2015, he announced that he was entering the United States presidential election race of 2016. In 2017, President Trump appointed him chairman of the President's Commission on Combating Drug Addiction and the Opioid Crisis. He is the author of the New York Times bestseller entitled, Let Me Finish, Trump, the Kushners, Bannon, New Jersey, and the Power of In-Your-Face Politics. And he is now a senior legal and political commentator for ABC News. Please welcome Governor Chris Christie. Welcome. Thank you. Our third guest is a political advisor, reform advocate, media columnist, and television producer. He was the chief media advisor to five successful presidential primary and general election campaigns and is co-founder of No Labels, an organization dedicated to bipartisanship, to civil dialogue, and to political problem solving. He presently serves as the co-host of the hit Showtime Weekly documentary series, The Circus, inside the greatest political show on earth, which provides unique access and insights into the 2016 presidential campaign and the Trump presidency. He has been a regular columnist for The Daily Beast and The Daily Telegraph, and was a consultant to two television series, The Newsroom and House of Cards. An award-winning media producer and communications strategist, Mr. McKinnon has been awarded more than 30 Polly and Telly Awards, honoring the nation's best political and public affairs advertising. So please welcome Mark McKinnon. Welcome. And of course, moderating our discussion is the man who created this lecture series, the former congressman for this district. Don't mind me repeating this, I want to. The former congressman for this district, director of the Office of Management and Budget, White House Chief of Staff, director of the CIA, and Secretary of Defense. He has a deep understanding of the important roles Congress and the press play and their complex relationship with our democracy. So please welcome our own Leon Panetta.
Thank you very much. Good evening and welcome to the second forum of the Panetta Lecture Series. Our theme, as you know, is checks and balances. Will our democracy survive? That theme becomes more relevant every day these days. We, in the last session, talked about the law as a check and talked about the Mueller investigation. And now we have the Mueller report, and we'll get a chance to discuss that. We'll also discuss two other institutions in our democracy that are critical to checks and balances, a free press and the Congress. Successful presidents like Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Ronald Reagan knew how to deal with both the Congress and the press. Other presidents have fought both and suffered the consequences. So the question we'll be talking about tonight is, how do these issues impact on this president and on our nation? And we'll be talking with three very distinguished speakers about these and many other issues. So let me begin, if I can, with the report that just came out from Bob Mueller. I like to say that it's important that we provide a little bit of caution that Winston Churchill used during World War II. Soon after they defeated Rommel for the first time in the Battle of Egypt, Churchill went before the Parliament and said, "This is not the end. It is not even the beginning of the end, but perhaps it is the end of the beginning." With that caution, I'd like you to talk about the Mueller report and its findings. There are two main findings, and I'll quote from the Barr letter. "The investigation did not establish that members of the Trump campaign conspired or coordinated with the Russian government in its election interference activities." That's the first finding. And then two, and this was a quote from the Mueller report itself, "While this report does not conclude that the president committed a crime with regards to obstruction of justice, it also does not exonerate him. At the same time, the attorney general made the decision that because there's no underlying crime, that he would not pursue any action on that issue." What does all of this mean? Where do we go from here? Is this the end, or is this the beginning? Mark?
Yes. It is. Those of us who praised Bob Mueller for the past 22 months, or even before that, would be well advised to remind ourselves what we said about him, which was true then and is true now. And that is, Bob Mueller is a patriot. Bob Mueller is thorough. Bob Mueller is a great lawyer and a great professional. That was the case before he submitted the report, while he was working on it, before he ever became counsel. So I think that's important to bear in mind. Those who were vilifying Bob Mueller as recently as last Friday and now praise him to the skies have revealed their own colors at this. A very wise man wrote the Trump group is composed of a revolving door of deeply flawed individuals, amateurs, grifters, convicted and non-convicted felons who were hustled into jobs they were never suited for, seemingly without a background check, even Google or Wikipedia. Let me finish the New York Times best-selling book by Governor Christie.
Good luck, baby.
And I say that because we can't. It is believable that these people could not organize a cooperation, collaboration with Russia, even though Russia was more than willing and more than eager. I think that now the temptation and the problem for the Democrats is that they can't let go of this. Once having caught the car, the dog wants to hang on to the to the dashboard or the drive, or the drive, or the sideboard. And I think that's a mistake. I think that Russia is resolved. I think there are obviously other issues about Donald Trump, his business, New York, everything else. And those are being pursued by professionals, conscientious professionals. And I think the Democrats would be well served not to rerun the Russian melodrama. And I don't think the country would be either.
Mark? Chris?
Let me finish, available on Amazon and BarnesandNoble.com, so you can get the full context of the quote that Mark gave you. Listen, I think a few things are of note from the report. The first one is, Mark is right, it puts the whole argument of collusion to bed. If Bob Mueller, after interviewing 500 witnesses, 2,800 subpoenas, and over $40 million spent, didn't find it, then we just have to admit it's not there. Bob Mueller couldn't find it, no one's going to find it. Didn't happen. That's a good thing for the country.
It is.
Like, you know, for those people who are anti-Trump and who are mourning this, I asked them to take a deep breath and think about the country for a second. Because the idea that we'd have someone in the Oval Office who would conspire with a foreign government, a hostile foreign government, in order to interfere with an American election is an awful, awful thought for this country. So it's good news that Bob Mueller found what he found, regardless of whether you're a Trump supporter or a Trump opponent. Secondly, on the obstruction stuff, I would say this. Let's remember something. It's not a prosecutor's job to exonerate anyone. Bob Mueller was appointed a special counsel, special prosecutor, inside the Justice Department by the Justice Department, by Rod Rosenstein. His job was to find out what happened in Russia and any crimes that might be related to that. When we do the job as a prosecutor, which I did for 7 years, you don't exonerate people. You either charge them or you don't. And the reason we don't exonerate is because we don't need to. Every one of you out here, every one of you is presumed innocent. Under our Constitution, you walk this country presumed innocent until the prosecutor can prove you guilty in a court of law before a jury of your peers beyond a reasonable doubt. And so we don't need to exonerate someone. If they're not charged with a crime, that's the end of the discussion because you're presumed innocent. And I think we lose that, and especially political figures lose that presumption. They shouldn't. They have a presumption, as we all do, of innocence under our system. We should have it. Third thing is, to amplify what Mark said about Bob Mueller. I was one of those Republicans out there who was saying all along, Bob Mueller is a man of integrity. He's going to do a great job. He's going to be thorough. He's going to be professional. And whatever conclusions he comes to are going to be come to in a way that's going to make the country proud. And so think about what he did. This is a guy who was making multi-million dollars at a law firm. And he left it for 22 months after, by the way, already having given us 11 years as FBI director, a number of years as U.S. attorney in San Francisco, as an assistant U.S. attorney in Washington, D.C., as a member of the Marine Corps. Decades of service to this country. He gave us 2 more years and did it in a way that should make all of us proud. No leaks, no politics, no games. Think about this last point to show you how extraordinary Bob Mueller is. He, along with Donald Trump, has dominated the last 22 months of news, yet you've never heard his voice. Not once. Bob Mueller has not made a public comment about this matter once. Even yesterday, when he's walking out of church across the street from the White House with reporters everywhere, not only didn't he talk, he didn't even smile. Had his wife's hand, made his way to their car, got out of Dodge. That is a professional prosecutor, but more importantly, that's a patriot. And he shouldn't have been attacked by the president. And I told the president that over and over again, that you're barking up the wrong tree here. Don't attack this guy. He doesn't deserve it. Doesn't merit it. And I think his conduct over the last 22 months and with the delivery of his report proves that. We should feel good tonight as Americans, regardless how you feel about the president. Our justice system worked. Last point is Barr confirmed in that letter, never once was the investigation interfered with. Never once was Mueller ask for something that he didn't get. And that's a tribute to Rod Rosenstein and to Matt Whitaker and to Bill Barr right at the very end, that there was no politics involved. If Bob Mueller wanted a resource, he wanted another prosecutor, he wanted five more agents, he wanted more subpoenas, whatever he wanted to do, he was never once denied it. You know what that tells us? We still are a country that is governed by the rule of law, and we should all feel really good about that.
Mark?
So while there's some resolution here this weekend on the Mueller front, it is only the beginning of the end on the legal front, because for one primary reason, Donald Trump never thought he was going to be president. He went to run for president to get a big spotlight on the biggest stage possible, get as much attention as he could, and he planned to go back. Then he was going to endorse Chris Christie for president. He can confirm this for you.
Yeah.
And he was going to go back to running the Trump business. Had he thought that he was going to be president, he probably wouldn't have run, because if he was going to be president, it was pretty likely that at some point they were going to look into his business dealings from New York. Now, you just cannot be a successful real estate developer in New York and not have some issues and some problems. So I've always said that collusion is probably the least of his problems. And as Chris will confirm, they weren't capable of collusion. They had too many other things trying to organize on other fronts. So the big problem, the real legal exposure, and I think the legal problems will extend for a long time and probably go much deeper from the Southern District of New York. In the short term, I agree with my colleagues here that this is a good thing for the country. We've tested the guardrails of democracy and they held up. This is great for the reputation of Bob Mueller, which needed no burnishing, but had been questioned, particularly by the president and his allies. It's good for the FBI. It's good for our justice system, and the trust in our justice system had been eroded. That is dangerous for democracy. So we now have a clean bill, at least for now, a clean bill on the justice system. It has done its job, and it's done its job well. So that's a win for the country. It's a win for the Justice Department. It's a win for Robert Mueller. It's a win for Nancy Pelosi. Now, she's the one that held the reins on everybody jumping over the cliff on impeachment proceedings, which was really wise strategically. It looks even smarter now. I think in the long run, this is good for the president, obviously. It makes it more of a challenge for the Democrats in some ways, although I would argue that strategically, this will be better for the Democrats in the long run, because instead of it being about impeachment or something that Donald Trump would martyr, hang himself as, brand himself as the martyr of the deep state, now it's going to be fought over issues. Instead of impeaching the president, which would have always been questioned by the Trump base and a lot of Americans, they've got to go beat him at the ballot box. And so I think that, as Trump proved in 2016, you should not take him lightly. He's got a hard core of support in the Republican Party. But it's a whole different ballgame because of the Mueller findings, and I think it now will make it a much better election for the country and outcome for the country.
Chris, you mentioned this in the book, but you've known Trump for almost 17 years. And I guess, it'd be interesting, I mean, you talk about this in the book, but who is this guy? Obviously there, the words are out there, whether it's narcissist, racist, con man, cheat, but he's also viewed, and you mentioned it in his book, as somebody who is incredibly confident, somebody who's fearless, somebody who obviously wants to win, New York developer. You've dealt with him for an awful lot. Who is he?
Well, let me start by telling you who he isn't. He's not a racist. Now, I've been with this guy for 17 years in every different type of setting, and I absolutely believe I could tell if he was a racist or he wasn't. I've never heard him say anything that was racially insensitive, let alone racist. And I've seen how he interacts with people both that he's worked with and that he knows, who are of varying ethnic and racial and religious backgrounds. I've never seen this in him. So I don't believe he's a racist. I've always said he's a salesman. Begin with the fact that he's a salesman. He's selling constantly. He's always selling. And salesmen, as we've all been exposed to over time, tend to be a bit hyperbolic. Their relationship to the complete and totally accurate facts are sometimes distanced. Because what they want more than anything else is for you to buy what they're selling. For Donald Trump, for decades, that was real estate and different real estate projects in New York City, predominantly in Manhattan. Once he got into politics, it was a whole different ballgame. He is fearless. He is also maddening because he's smart enough to know not to do certain things, like lie about the fact that he was involved in getting a security clearance for his son-in-law and his daughter when he has the absolute right as president to give them one, yet he lied about it. It is maddening for those of us who are his friend and who support him to lie about things that you have no reason to lie about. And that's maddening. There are maddening points to him. There are times when he doesn't listen. But there are other times when he is a great listener and you can persuade him. So I guess what I'm saying in the end, Leon, is that what you see is what you get. There is not, like, you know, you used to hear about Al Gore. Oh, you know, if you saw Al Gore privately, boy, is he fun. What a great guy Al Gore is one-on-one. I mean, I've never bought that, but there are people who have said, Al Gore, amazing guy one-on-one, right? You've heard this stuff about different politicians over time who have a certain public persona, but you go, but in private, they're totally different. Here's the good news and the bad news. In private, he is absolutely the same as he is in public. Absolutely the same. Hyperbolic. He talks all the time. He's always selling you. He's just that way. And so I've known him for 17 years. I was at his wedding. I've been, you know, we would go out to dinner 4 or 5 times a year in New York. I mean, we spent a lot of time together. But that's who he is. And as far as the other stuff, the psychiatric, diagnoses. I know you're going to find this hard to believe, but there are some people in politics who place themselves ahead of anything else. I know this is a newsflash for everybody in this room. I think Donald Trump is one of those folks. He's going to put his interests as he perceives them to be first and foremost. But that's not a shock to anybody. Now, there'll be people who will characterize him differently because they don't know him in the way that I know him. I'm answering the guy that I know. And other people have different views of him, and I, you know, understand and welcome those views. But he is about what you see him being, except for, you know, some of those other, I think, more unseemly allegations, which, quite frankly, I just have never seen in my relationship with him.
Mark, you work for John McCain. What do you sense is this aggravation with John McCain?
Well, I think part of his aggravation was that he believed that somehow John McCain was responsible for the beginning of all the legal trouble that he got into, although that's not accurate or fair. And I think he's so different than John McCain just in his life experience. And I don't think he understood. He didn't like the fact that people thought he was a patriot, that he was somehow on Mount Rushmore and Trump wasn't yet. Let me just say one thing really quickly about the person Trump is, and this is from a media perspective, not as a friend. He's a master storyteller, right? So we think about storytelling and narrative architecture in terms of film, books, music. The same is true for campaigns and great candidates. Great campaigns and great candidates tell a story. So when we deal with candidates, how do we break it down like this? We say, voters don't want just a bunch of disparate information. They want you to connect it up so it has some meaning. So how do we do that? Well, we tell them, establish a threat or an opportunity out there, or both. Identify the victims of the threat or the denied opportunity. Identify the villain imposing the threat or denying the opportunity. Provide a solution, reveal the hero. Okay, that's the narrative thread. Now think about this in terms of the last campaign. No matter who you supported, who told the story? Well, I can tell you what Donald Trump's story was. What's the opportunity? Make America great again. What's the threat? Others coming across and making our country different and taking away our way of life. Who are the villain? Who are the victims? Middle-class Americans losing their job and their quality of life. Who are the villains? Mexican rapists, Chinese bad trade deals, the media elites in Washington. What's the resolution? Build a wall, tear up the trade deal, drain the swamp. Who's the hero? Donald Trump. What was Hillary Clinton's story? Not a clue.
Mark? You want to jump in on this?
I will. I will probably not associate myself with the remarks of either of my two colleagues. I have the highest regard and affection. I'd start with three quick examples. This is the state of Ronald Reagan. I covered Ronald Reagan, and Ronald Reagan was remarkable in this sense. He was totally comfortable in his own skin. He knew who he was. He wasn't earning a varsity letter. He wasn't dependent upon the praise or the adulation of anybody else or the press. Example, Ronald Reagan used to say things that didn't have a strong empirical foundation to them. There was no attempt to deceive because deception was not in his soul. But along the way, it had been a long way. He picked things up. They got on his 5x8 cards. Sometimes they didn't stand scrutiny. And I remember one of his favorite, we were in Steubenville, Ohio. Ronald Reagan stood up and said, trees cause more pollution than automobiles. We all headed for the phones because we knew this was as good as it was going to get. I mean, you're not, you know, and the next time you're in New Jersey Turnpike, your eyes are watering, the diesel in front of you, blame a pine tree in Maine. So our next stop is in Southern California. Ronald Reagan, Governor Reagan's going out to Claremont College to speak. And some wise guy graduate student hung a sign on a tree. It said, cut me down before I kill again. Nobody laughed harder than Ronald Reagan. But more important than that, Ronald Reagan, of all the presidents I've ever covered, reached out to hire as his chief of staff the man who would run the last two campaigns against him. Think about that. Jim Baker ran George H.W. Bush's campaign in 1980, Voodoo Economics. He ran principal architect of Gerry Ford's campaign in 1976. And Ronald Reagan was comfortable enough with himself, he could reach out to get him. And that to me is a test of somebody's comfort. Donald Trump has, in spite of Governor Christie's best efforts, he has dwelt in the shallow pool of talent in the Republican Party. I mean, he really has. I mean, these are people you wouldn't think would be in a lieutenant governor's race in Wyoming, I mean, that he has in high positions. John McCain, whom I covered for 36 years, knew who he was. John McCain was comfortable who he was. John McCain, Donald Trump said he didn't like people who were captured. John McCain spent 5.5 years in an 8x12 cell in the Hanoi Hilton. And when he went to campaign in 2000 in New Hampshire and in Iowa, the people campaigning with him were the people who had spent 5.5 years in a prison camp being tortured with him. Colonel Bud Day, Medal of Honor winner, Orson Swindle, 6 years, a Marine pilot knocked down, Edward Alvarez, who spent 8.5 years. They were all up there on their own dime campaigning for John McCain. Now, that says something about somebody. And the idea of savaging John McCain 7 months later, after John McCain is in the ground, I don't know, I don't want to get psychological about it, psychiatrical about it. It is bizarre. I mean, it is, and it is not.
By the way, this bracelet that I wear says WWJMD, what would John McCain do? And it's got his POW number on it, and I'm sending it to all 100 senators.
Let me turn to freedom of the press. I want to read this quote from Eric Severide, who some of us will remember. used to do commentary on CBS. Our rigid formula of so-called objectivity have given the lie the same prominence and impact the truth is given. They have elevated the influence of fools to that of wise men, the ignorant to the level of the learned, and the evil to the level of the good. So, reporter, obviously seeks objectivity and fairness, but at the same time gives equal status to both the good and the bad. I want to ask this question. You know, with all of the media, and we've obviously gone through a great transition in terms of the media. We started with small party journals that covered Jefferson and Adams. We went to newspapers, big newspaper chains. We went to the radio. FDR knew how to use the radio. Ronald Reagan knew how to use television in that era. And now we're living in the information age. We've got social media sites all over the place. You got Snapchat, BuzzFeed, all of this. I mean, names I can't even think about that kids are into looking at different sites. We've got cable news. We've got Fox. We've got MSNBC. We've got newspapers. Local newspapers are having a harder time, but obviously the major newspapers are in kind of a boon period with what's going on. But it's a time of a lot of fake news, a lot of attacks, a lot of false details that are out there. If you're an average citizen here, who do you turn to get the truth? Who do you turn to get the truth?
Well, this, Mark, I think, is one of the real consequences and most fundamental questions of our time, which is, what is the truth anymore? And this notion that somehow we can have alternative facts. There should only be one truth. And yet we have a situation in which Macedonian teenagers pumped in fake news information into our election, into our election cycle. And that's just Macedonian teenagers. We don't know exactly what Russia did or other state actors. So, and we have, as Secretary Panetta said, we have something called confirmation bias, which means that we have so many news and information outlets that we all seek out information that we already believe, and it just reinforces what we already believe, so we don't get any breadth of information. So it's a real question about, if we're not dealing with the same facts, how can we ever come to any sort of agreement? And I saw that during our show one time when we were covering two different news outlets. One event happened, and the way they reported it was like two completely different events. And so I think that is something that has real consequences. I'm optimistic about this for a couple of reasons. One is that because of what we learned about this last election, both about Russia and Macedonia and other people interfering in our election and our news, that suddenly people, including myself, said, oh my gosh, there is a bunch of information out there that is real fake news. I mean, there is fake news out there. Not just fake news, as the president says it's fake news because he doesn't like it, but there are people creating false news stories intentionally to mislead people. So as consumers and voters, we are more aware and hopefully have become more discerning about that so that we question what we see. And I think as part of that, we're now moving toward more branded news sites that we trust. That's why the New York Times is doing well. That's why the Wall Street Journal is doing well, because those are brands we trust, and people, I think, have become to distrust a lot of what they see. That's a good thing. The second thing is that we have this move to this flight to quality. We're losing a lot of local stations, but the big legacy companies are doing really well. And additionally, I think that another good development is that there's a lot of scrutiny and potential regulation on actors and platforms like Facebook, who are the repositories of a lot of this information. So either they've got to clean up their act or the government's going to do it.
Chris?
I mean, I think if you're gonna look for the truth, you got to go to multiple places to find it. I just think that if you're someone who's right of center and all you do is watch Fox, you're not doing yourself a favor. And if you're left of center and all you're doing is watching MSNBC or CNN, you're not doing yourself a favor. I get three newspapers every day. I get the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and the New York Post. Let me tell you why. New York Times, because I want to know what people who don't think like me are talking about. The Wall Street Journal, because I want to know what smart people who think like me are talking about. And the New York Post, because I just want to have fun. Right? I want to see what the headline is that day on the New York Post. I want to go into page six and see where McKinnon's having dinner. I want to find that stuff out, too. And I think you have to go to multiple places anymore. I don't think there's any one place, if there ever was. Now, I grew up in a time, as you all did, where it was like CBS, NBC, ABC, Evening News, you know, Walter Cronkite, David Brinkley, you know, John Chancellor. These guys were the truth. Mm-hmm. When Walter Cronkite said it, of course it was true, because Walter Cronkite said it. There is not a media figure like that right now in our country. There isn't any one person you go like, oh, well, you know, if you know, Sean Hannity says it, it's got to be true, right?
Absolutely.
Or
Rachel Maddow.
Rachel Maddow. Got to be true if Rachel says it. She's very smart, right? And, you know, there's not that anymore. You've got to go and find your way. And the last thing I'd say about this is, you know, we have an obligation. We're not lambs being led to slaughter unless we want to be on the information front. We have common sense, and we know that there's not any one person who is the owner of the truth of any particular story. So it's a little harder now. We gotta go out, we gotta spend some time. But we all have these phones, and we can zip around it pretty quickly and find out what we need to find out. And I think it's on us to find out the truth from the various places that we look, and not always look, as Mark talked about, to confirm what it is we believe. I'd much rather challenge what I believe, because you know what it does? It makes me a lot more confident. When I read the Times editorial page and the Times op-ed page, I'm like, yeah, man, I am right. Listen to this stuff, right? That to me is much greater confirmation than if I just read the Journal or just watched Fox News, because I wouldn't feel like I'm being intellectually challenged.
Mark?
The assault on the press is real, make no mistake about it. And it's not restricted to this administration, although it's the first time we've had a sustained assault from the Oval Office. And first of all, without truth and a common fidelity to truth, democracy is not possible. I mean, it really isn't. And when you've got the most powerful, influential voice in the Western world, or in the entire world, saying fake news each time, and ignoring the fact that last year in this world there were 82 journalists killed for practicing their craft. And this is not limited to the United States by any means. It's the Duterte is Philippines, it's Assad Syria, it's the same language, enemy of the people, fake news. And I will say this about having worked at the Washington Post, that when you make a mistake in the newspaper business, there's an accountability for it. There is an errors page, there is a corrections page, there's an editor's page. And Mark Shields was wrong yesterday when he said that Camden was the capital of New Jersey rather than Trenton or whatever else, but even in a more real and relevant way. This is a good feature of American journalism. Is there arrogance and hubris on the part of the press? You better believe it. I think this Mueller report may be a little case of humility, a dose of humility on all our parts. But we can't function effectively as this marvelous democracy in this diverse continental nation of ours, of so many people from so many different places, with so many different points of view, unless we agree on what facts are. Barack Obama was born in Honolulu. He was not born in Kenya. There were not 5 million votes cast illegally in this country in 2016, and that's the only reason Donald Trump lost the popular election. That is untrue. There have been, in the past 16 years in this country, 1 billion votes cast in elections. An exhaustive study by both Loyola University and the Brennan Center came up with 61 cases of voter imitation. That is where I went in and said, I'm voting Mark McKinnon's name or Leon Panetta's name and voting in my own name as well. That's it. That's true. I mean, that undermines our confidence in our institutions and in each other and in our democracy. And I would like to see a similar accountability in the political order that there is in print journalism. And I agree with my colleagues on the case of silo viewership, and that is just watching those who agree with you. I think it's an abdication of citizenship, not to test your ideas and to listen to the other side. And that's one of the tragedies of what happened with the repeal of the equal time law. I mean we did grow up when Walter Cronkite was the most trusted man in America, and for good reason that he was. And he accepted the responsibility of that burden and that blessing. But now, MSNBC can have a profitable business plan by talking only to liberal Democrats or liberals or Democrats or anti-Trumpers. And Fox obviously can have a successful business plan by just catering to those true believers on their side. And never the twain shall meet, and we just end up demonizing and vilifying each other, which is not healthy for our country.
We've reached the midway point, and I've got a lot of questions here to go through, but let me pause to acknowledge our question review team. It's the people who are responsible for selecting the questions that are presented to our speakers. So I'd ask you to hold your applause while I introduce the entire group. They are Doug McKnight, who's a reporter with KAZU Radio, David Kellogg, who's managing editor of the Monterey Herald, Fran Gaver, who's our veteran question review team member, Paul Miller, the publisher of the Carmel Pinecone, and Joe Sadowski, who is a reporter with the Salinas, California. If you would thank them. We also have a group of students representing those who attended the afternoon student program. We had a very successful student program. Our speakers were great and the questions were great. Let me ask all of the students in the audience to please stand and remain standing until I recognize the schools that you represent. Those schools are 7 schools: Gavilan College, Middlebury Institute of International Studies, Monterey County Office of Education, the Alternative Education Program, Monterey Peninsula College, San Jose State University, Santa Clara University, and the University of California at Santa Cruz.
Wow. You were there.